I've been preaching from lessons from My Utmost to His Highest, which is a daily prayer book that some of us, study book that some of us in the church use on a weekly basis. Selma is here. I'm just trying to think who else. Brian's part of that group. Sally's part of that group. Don's probably at home watching. There's a few others in the group too as well. So Carol. Ruth, there's this, you know, I think there's seven of us, but this is from July 30th, the teaching of disillusionment. So the source of this message is from Oswald Chambers' teaching on July 30th. But I'm not going to quote him every time I mention him. The word disillusion is typically associated with disappointment, disenchantment, and dissatisfaction. Maybe you really liked a political leader, but over time you became dissatisfied with their leadership or their approach to issues. There's a sense of deflation in your initial enthusiasm. I had that experience with Barack Obama. I was really enthusiastic about him when he broke into the scene back in early 2008. And I went to downtown for a week's holidays with a friend of mine in downtown Chicago in August of 2008. And I was so excited to be there because, as you know maybe, Chicago was Obama's hometown. That's where he's from, at least as an adult. And it was so exciting to be there. And there was a lot of Obama posters up and such. In fact, I meant to bring a cap that I bought. I was in the car when I realized I'd forgotten it. And it's in my condition, it's like a 10 or 15 minute journey back to get it. So you're going to have to imagine. But I bought a cap with, you know, Obama and the symbol of his campaign on it. It was surprisingly actually hard to find. You'd think in his hometown you'd have lots of hats. I had to go to a bunch of novelty stores before I finally found the hat. And we were one day walking through downtown Chicago, and there was this big noise. The crowd was cheering and such, and we found out later that it was a live taping of an Oprah Winfrey show outside with Obama as the guest. Now, Obama was a smart and savvy guy, for sure. He seemed to represent a real change in the winds of U.S. politics. But over the past 16 years, I've grown a bit disillusioned about his effectiveness as a U.S. president. I think he was an okay president. Don't get me wrong. I don't think he was a bad president. I just don't think he was a great president. I think he's kind of finds himself in the middle of U.S. presidents. And you know, I think about it in retrospect, I think he was probably a bit too inexperienced to be president. He hadn't even finished a full term as a U.S. senator. And he'd been a state legislator before that, a community activist before that. And I suppose in life, becoming a bit disillusioned about people is pretty natural. You fall in love. And the person you are with is the best thing since sliced bread. They can do no wrong, and their idiosyncrasies you find charming, endearing. And then at some point, what happens? You wake up. You wake up, and their flaws are now more obvious to you. And their idiosyncrasies aren't so much endearing as annoying. And their selfishness becomes more apparent, and their humanness becomes more obvious. And there's a sense of disenchantment that takes place. The enchantment is gone. The spell is over. And what are we going to do? What are you going to do when you come to that moment where the enchantment has been taken away with that person, whatever relationship they have with you? Are you going to celebrate? Are you going to be happy about that? Is that a good thing to happen to you? Is it happy to see the truth about who that person really is? No, we tend to become disillusioned. And I'll tell you what a lot of people do when they become disillusioned. They dump the person, and they move on to someone else. They move away and look for something or someone new. They look for something or someone better. They look again for that enchantment. See, the true meaning of the word disillusion is to lose the illusion. That's what the dis part means. Take it away. Take away the illusion. It's to have the illusion taken away, to live starkly in the truth of reality. And surprisingly, that's not something that we enjoy doing a lot of the time. I want the illusion. I want the tingling of being in love. I want to be infatuated by my leaders. I want to think that Obama was the best president ever. I want to believe that my team is the best team in the league. It's been a hard crash for us who are Blue Jays fans to watch the team kind of fall apart. I thought they were the best team in Major League Baseball at the beginning of the season. I've become disillusioned with the team and the franchise. See, I want to be in love with life, and I don't want reality to get in the way. But reality does get in the way. And when reality intercedes into the moment, then the question is, what are we going to do about it? How do we respond when our illusions get in the way? How do we respond when our illusions get dispelled? How do we cope with the truth? There's Jesus. He's at the very beginning of his ministry. He's just launching his ministry. It says that people are starting to recognize his spiritual power. They're starting to see the movement of God in his life. They recognize something special about him, and they get really excited. They get enthusiastic about him. They start believing that he might actually be who he claims to be. They are enchanted by him. And as they say, they have a real powerful enthusiasm for him. But John's gospel says that Jesus didn't get caught up in their enthusiasm. He did not entrust himself to their enchantments. He did not try to ingratiate himself with the crowds or encourage them to think along this line. Because, John says, Jesus knew all people, which means he understood human nature. He recognized how people work. He knew that at some point he would disappoint them. That they would lose their enchantment about him. They were currently cheering him on, of course, yes, but at some point they would turn away. They would become disillusioned, and in that disillusionment, they would become disappointed and unsatisfied with what he represented. See, Jesus did not allow himself to get caught up in the excitement of other people's enthusiasm for him, because he knew it couldn't last. He knew it wouldn't last. At least their enthusiasm had not gone through the testing of disillusionment. And as history proves, his decision not to entrust himself to their enthusiasm proved wise. It was a wise decision on his part. He did not trust their untested enthusiasm. Disillusionment means we have no more misconceptions. It means having no more misconceptions, false impressions, and false judgments in life. It means being free from these deceptions. But here's the problem. Now, once free from being deceived, now no longer being deceived, our experience of disillusionment may actually leave us cynical and overly critical in our judgments of others. In the nakedness of truth about others, we might become sour about human nature, about human potential, about the human propensity to selfishness and self-interest. I have a friend of mine who's still single all these years on. He's about my age. I figure he's probably had 100 girlfriends in his life. Think about that, 100 girlfriends, right? He's gone through the power and process of enchantment and disenchantment 100 times. And you can imagine now that he's single that he's pretty disillusioned. He's quite cynical about romance and about relationships generally. I know my mom became disillusioned about being a parent. You know, being a parent's supposed to be great. You have these kids, everything goes peachy keen for your life. It's the most noble and wonderful thing you could do. It's all a happy moment, isn't it? It's just all joy and peace in your life when you're a parent. But then she had three selfish, self-absorbed young male teenagers in her life. Yeah, and it soured her on the whole parenting gig. I got to tell you, I remember her several times saying to me, "Why did I do this? I don't know why I did this." I've become rather cynical about politics and politicians. Anybody else like that at all? I've been having a little extra free time because of my injury, and I've been paying a bit more attention to the political campaigns in the U.S. because they have, you know, U.S. presidential election. It seems to go on forever, if you notice. Here's my disillusioned and cynical prediction. Both sides will try to destroy each other. They will try to mischaracterize each other. They will distort each other's records. They will engage in name-calling and personal assassination. And let me emphasize, both sides. Because we only tend to pick up the other side doing it. We don't recognize it when our side does it. But both sides are doing it today. And I've become very disillusioned and cynical about our news media as well. I mean, listen to the interviews of political candidates. There's, on TV and Sunday mornings are the political shows in the U.S. Look how little actual issues are discussed in those interviews with political candidates. There's almost no conversation about real issues and real solutions. The media doesn't seem to be interested in issues. They want confrontation, and they want the conflict, and they want the drama and the clicks. And the whole system seems to be set up as a cartoon show. And that's why the news media today is held in such low regard. I saw a poll. 50% of Americans today believe that national news organizations intentionally mislead, misinform, or persuade people to adopt a particular point of view through their reporting. And I don't think it's much different in Canada either. News media today is seen by many to be about manipulation and not facts. And there's deep cynicism today in the public towards dissemination of news, which is sad and unfortunate and a tragedy for our society. And the problem is that we never seem to get around to thinking seriously about the real problems and the potential real solutions and the trade-offs that they all bring to us. We don't get a chance to investigate issues and think through them at a deeper level. The whole political culture today is instead performative. So there is where my cynicism comes out of. That's why I'm cynical about it all. But the spiritual journey of Jesus is a journey to disillusionment. Understand that. The journey that Jesus calls us on is a journey to disillusionment. Jesus wants to bring us to the point where we put our illusions down and see people as they really are, see institutions as they really are, yet without any cynicism or stinging or bitter criticism. And there's my challenge, personally. Maybe yours, too. I think the reason for our journey to disillusionment, at least our Christian journey to disillusionment, is that illusions ultimately inflict great injury, pain, and grief upon our lives. See, they may feel good in the moment. Being in love feels good in the moment, but it's not ultimately good to be separated from reality. And it will come back to bite you, as my friend with 100 girlfriends knows. And when we don't see each other as we really are, then we're bound to embrace misconceived ideas of one another that ultimately builds distrust, disharmony, and disappointment. In the world of illusions, everything is moved to being delightful and good, or evil, malicious, and cowardly, and the world becomes polarized. And we see that happening right in our own culture today. Oswald Chambers, I've got a slide up there for you, Deb. You can follow along with it for people. Oswald Chambers says it wonderfully in the lesson I'm using. He says this: refusing to be disillusioned is the cause of much of the suffering of human life. And this is how that suffering happens. If we love someone but do not love God, we demand total perfection and righteousness from that person. And when we do not get it, we become cruel and vindictive. Yet we are demanding of a human being something which he or she cannot possibly give. In our illusion, we expect people to be perfect and righteous, all loving and all sacrificing. We believe that people should always live with high integrity, never stumbling in their own self-interest. And when that doesn't happen, when people don't meet our expectations of how they should be, when they don't live up to our standards for them, then we can easily become, as Chambers says, vindictive and cruel in our estimation of them in our minds. And we can say nasty things to them. We can certainly become deeply disappointed and frustrated in life. See, we're asking of people what they cannot give us. There is no perfect person in this congregation. I know it's hard to believe, but I'm not perfect. And neither are you. In fact, all of us have major flaws in our personalities. All of us have difficult idiosyncrasies to deal with. All of us do. Every one of us. There's no perfect spouse. There's no perfect child. There's no perfect parent. There's no perfect politician. There's no perfect church either. One of the challenges of our lives is that we keep asking from others what cannot be given to us. We want the perfect love all the time from our neighbor. Whoever that neighbor might be, whether it's our spouse, our parents, our child, our friends, our work colleagues. And again, we're disappointed by them when they can't deliver on this. And we become disillusioned and perhaps cynical and dispirited. There is only one being that can fully love us completely, totally in the way that we need to be loved. There's only one being that can do that, and that is God. God is love. That's our Christian understanding. God does not only love, God is love. That's the Christian claim about God. God is love, perfect love, what the New Testament calls agape love. And that God of love has come to us in a person named Jesus. Jesus Christ is the one who can completely satisfy to the absolute depth the needs of our hurting human hearts. It's Jesus who shows us the true nature of God, which is love, a love that goes the extra mile in every situation, a love that extends itself in every situation we can imagine. And we need to turn to the Lord for that special kind of love that only He can provide us. We need to go to the heavenly gas station to get that heavenly love filled up into our tank. It's only when we turn to God, it's only when we turn to God that we can stop torturing the people around us, even the institutions around us, to be what they can't be. We stop torturing them. And don't get me wrong, I think we want to be our best. And we want other people to be their best too. That's what Trillium's about. We come weekly to gather and celebrate God's presence in our lives, the grace of God, the goodness of God, the love of God. And we know that people who anchor their life and their relationship with the Lord are more able to become their absolute best. That's where the anchoring takes place, and that's what allows us to launch into this life of love. When God sits on the throne of your life, your daily happiness is anchored in His grace. So we come here today at Trillium to learn the way of God's love and to let His light shine through us. And that's what it means to follow Jesus. And one of the effects of centering our life on the Lord is it allows people to be people. It's because we're not expecting them to be more than a person. We're not expecting them to be a little mini God in our life. We release people from our judgment and condemnation when we anchor our relationship in Jesus Christ and His love for us. When people fail our expectations, we forgive easily. And interestingly, when we root our lives in the Lord, we actually free up our capacity to love others as they truly are. Not as an illusion in our mind, but as they are truly in this reality. As they've been freed from the disillusion of our minds, we can love people as they are, not as we want them to be. Jesus trusted no one, never placed his ultimate faith in people, yet he was never suspicious or bitter. Jesus never embraced the need for illusions in his dealings with others. He never insisted that people be what they cannot be. Instead, he turned to God, found comfort in his relationship with his heavenly Father. It was a rock to him. It was the rock upon which he moved. And resting in his confidence in God, Jesus trusted in what God's grace could do for other people, for anyone, for you, me, anyone we could imagine. Jesus' confidence in his Father was so complete, was so perfect that he never despaired and he never gave up on anyone. And we sing that faith in church every Sunday. Most of our songs are about this. I don't know if you've noticed. Every Sunday we come to celebrate the love and grace that comes from God to us. That love and grace that's always forgiving, always extending, always blessing us. You know, one song in particular came to mind that we've been learning recently. It goes like this. Nobody loves me like you love me, Jesus. I stand in awe of your amazing ways. I worship you as long as I am breathing. God, you are faithful and true. Nobody loves me like you. What the song's about. Anchoring our love in God and in the Lord, so that now we're free to love our neighbor as they are. And once we know this love, once we know God's love for us, once we rest ourselves in its embrace, then we're free to love others as they are, not as they ought to be, but as they are. And that's probably the greatest gift we could ever bring anyone.